Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hello, I'm Diana Montalian. I'm a systems architect and author of Learning Systems Thinking, and I get the incredible privilege and joy to spend another 30 minutes of my life talking to Jessica Kerr, who Jessitron online. If you don't know her, she's very passionate about the intersection of code and people and semantasy, which is the learning system part of learning, meaning how we both embody a system and evolve it at the same time. So thank you, Jess, for spending time today. And I know we're going to talk about AI because we're talking about AI. And
it's the spring of 2025. You have to talk about AI.
Okay, and I'm in it. I have so many mixed feelings at the moment that I'm glad that's what we're going to talk about, because I think that I will be a bit untangled by the time we are. And one of the things that when I was thinking about today, I was thinking that the thing I value most about your work, your talks, and then just having coffee with you is how I can focus on whatever you're focusing on in terms of a system. Like, there's so many things. We can talk about the tech, we can talk about the people, we can talk about the learning, we can talk about the patterns, we can talk about AI, we can talk about events. And that if I follow you into a particular part of the discussion, it's always really fruitful. And so that's what I was thinking today. We do today about, like, following you into the thinking about AI as part of the system that we have now.
As part of the software and the software development.
Part of software and software development. Awesome. So where do we begin? Like, what's the context for us to start thinking about this?
Well, it is the spring of 2025, and these days it's really easy to recognize that the system is broken. Like, the much wider world system is quavering and clearly not working. You can't pretend that our system of government and across the world works the way I grew up thinking it worked, you know, as smoothly as I thought it worked, you know, where there were rules and if you followed them, you'd be fine. So the system is broken, and it's every year I realize it more and it sinks in more. But at the same time, as I notice that the system is broken, I can also notice, and life goes on, you know? It's not that the system is suddenly broken. It's always been broken. I mean, it has to be if it can deteriorate. And that means we've always been living in a broken system, but it's just like a distributed system in software. Some piece of it is failing somewhere, right? It's never perfectly working smoothly. And it's not that we wait until it perfectly works smoothly and then call it done. And then the software runs perfectly smoothly forever. No. It's, we work within the brokenness and among it, and we compensate, and we have redundancies, and we deal with surprises, and we look for surprises. And in software, sometimes we get to fix the brokenness sometimes. And other times we work around it. Not all of it is ours anyway, because our software is always working with other software. So yeah, once again, I find that working in software, distributed systems in particular, lets me have a handle on complexity. Not a handle like making it work perfectly, but a handle like moving forward anyway. And that works in life too.
Right. And that, like, as you're talking, I think about this grew up thinking these rules and structures were solid, real. The paradigm was what is truth. And I wonder if that's a constantly evolving thing. Like, I agree with what you're saying about we think it's in our lifetime, or we focus on this thing that we thought was true that we discover doesn't quite work the way we thought. But I think maybe everyone throughout time is always experiencing that shift, because we're always figuring something's, as you said, something's always broken.
Yeah,
something's
yeah.
always working and something's always broken. And I think that's when we talk about leverage points in systems, meaning the place where you can make a difference, where you can change something that really will have an impact rather than the shifting seats on Titanic. I love the way you're sort of describing that, which is in a system that we know is always broken and always working and always in relationship and always complex and never certain.
Yeah.
There are places we can intervene.
Yes. And this is very abstract, so I want to give concrete examples. It's safe to give concrete examples in software. So yeah, when your distributed system is having a bunch of failures, sometimes you get to fix the bug. Oh, that's a great day.
Right? Exactly. Exactly. Yay, it's in the code. It's right here. Right, it's right here. My for loop isn't working. Yay!
That makes sense. But other times, we don't get to make that kind of detailed, rational, I can reason this out sense. And we have to observe that there were a lot of errors. I can't reproduce it, but I can detect that a downstream service was timing out. It was timing out after 60 seconds, and my system was slowed down by holding all those connections open for 60 seconds. And I can't fix that downstream system. It's outside of my domain. But I can shorten my timeout, and I can ask, okay, when that system fails, what can we do? So here's something I've learned recently. The difference between morality universals and asking what should you do versus ethics, which are situational, and asking what can we do? The people we are, the relationships and response options that we have, what can we do? And what we can do is shorten the timeout, is do fallbacks, or give the user an informative message that says it's not working right now. It might work in a few minutes. Or I can tell you when it's back up. Unlikely, but if you're being really industrious, we get to decide how to respond to these failures. And that's really important. Now, you can't decide ahead of time how to respond to every possible failure, which gets us into AI-assisted coding, because, oh my gosh, the agent, when I let it write code, it checks every error 6 different times. And that's really messy. And some of those are never going to happen. And even when they do, you didn't actually do anything useful. You just fell back and you hid the error. It hides the errors. It's so good at hiding its own failures to be able to really write the code and the failures that happen at runtime. So that's one response option, is to hide the failure. And sometimes that's great if that gives the user a smooth enough experience and it's good enough. But much more often, it's hiding the failure from us as developers. And that I really want to avoid. Loudly fail to me, like in the telemetry at least, and then tell the user as much as they need to know. Yeah, so how we respond to failures matters so much more than preventing them.
Yeah, and I think of what I'm trying, what might translate in your saying, right, is that in software, like in life, improving boundaries, that we can improve our relationships with what we think of as the broken parts. And maybe they're not broken. Mm-hmm. Maybe in their context, slow is perfectly fine. But in our relationship to them,
yeah, I mean, maybe it's not them. Maybe they're fine and it's network.
Right. Or something in between.
Yeah, so, it's always in the connections.
Yeah. And how this is the same as what happens in my brain, that the rumination, like if I have a problem, what my brain wants to do is fix it, fix it, fix it, think about it, think about it, fix it. Or we're getting that from AI too. Like I just keep going. It's like a loose tooth or a hole in your tooth. You keep playing. We just keep going back to the problem.
And wiggles and wiggles and wiggles.
Yeah. And doing that so that, but the ability to respond rather to than react, shifting us towards improving the interaction, into improving the what we can, where the boundaries in which we can improve that relationship. And that's my question, I guess, about why I'm surprised that we're going to AI coding. Because one of the things for me is the challenge of inference. I would have assumed AI is actually bad at the gaps between knowing. Like I can know this part and how fast it goes, and I can know this part and what's going on in this part of the system. But these problems are about the inference between them, the relationship between them. But it sounds like you're having experiences that give you insight into how AI coding actually potentially helps us do better with that, helps us, at least supports the hard work of doing it.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Because sometimes we don't handle all the errors that our code could possibly throw just because it's more typing and it clutters up the code. And more typing is no longer a problem. It's very fast at typing. So I should clarify that with AI-assisted coding, at the moment, oh gosh, I was trying to write something yesterday in Java, which I haven't used very often recently, and I wasn't like signed in to my AI assistant correctly, to either Copilot or Augment Code, and it wasn't auto-completing, and I was like, what is wrong? I can't type this. This is Java. I don't remember the syntax. And I don't have an expectation of understanding at top of mind. I wrote Java for 12 years. It's not like I don't know Java syntax somewhere, but I don't need to go digging for it, right? I don't have that expectation anymore because something is going to type it for me.
Yeah.
I write the comment, if this is null, set an attribute, and the syntax is immediately handled for me. So it's good at typing. It can do more error handling when our restriction is like the time of typing it out, but it can't do the thinking. And all it can do is, this is what other people on the internet in open source code, in public repositories anyway, this is what people have done. And you know what I do in my public repositories? My public repositories are all demo apps.
Yeah.
I don't do good, robust error handling in my demo apps. I probably send a good error message because that's kind of one of my obsessions. And because I work in observability now, so I'm careful with my telemetry. But I absolutely don't think through all the timeouts and stuff. If my demo apps fail, great. Observability gets to shine. a great field to be speaking about with live demos, because every failure is an opportunity.
I like the show.
Yeah, which is a lovely way to feel. Anyway,
okay, I want a T-shirt that says that, right? Like, you. And that's really been in line with my experience, and I love the structure that. The reason I remain dubious, and yet I'm having really also positive experience of learning which tools help and how to use them and how to apply them. And I'm not really ready to, or I wasn't ready to admit that. Apparently I'm ready to admit that now. Only with you, Jess, only with you.
You only know when it comes out of your mouth.
Yeah, just between us. But that the typing for me it really has made me more effective and efficient because of the typing and also the synthesizing. I'm looking for patterns in a solution I don't know how to solve. So the fact that it goes to all of the repositories and answers and discussions in a way, not all of them, but in a way that can synthesize that, it takes me a lot longer to do that, to synthesize. And the debugging and the error handling, the recommendations are not always correct. Maybe they're not even often correct. But when they are correct, it has saved me a lot of time.
Well, and sometimes they're wrong in ways that leads me to the correct error.
Yeah.
Sometimes getting the AI to code something is inspiration to code it well.
Yeah, because isn't it wonderful when something's wrong? If something is wrong on the internet, I will now do it right. Exactly.
I know it's wrong so quickly in my IDE. And now, pretty often I'm like, no, go back to the beginning. Sometimes I'm like, no. Well, except actually that part is useful, but completely differently.
But so, for newer coders, for people that, I mean, we're talking about this, but we're often looking at things that we've looked at for, you know, years and years.
Right. When we look at bad code, we find it bad. I can't always define exactly why, but we've developed that taste over decades.
Yeah. So how is that, do you think, for newer developers, programmers using it as a tool who might not have that? I can sort of smell it when it's a thing. How do they learn to discern then what to use and what not to use in the answers?
Well, I'm not a new coder, so I'm probably not the person to ask, but a friend of mine who is new to coding uses AI. And one thing I observe is that she's able to just do more. Right. There's things that weren't approachable that are now that, yeah. So what if the code is bad? Does it matter? Sometimes we need to notice that in production and respond when it is. So I think observability is one more important because there's just more code and we don't yet know which errors we should be responding to and how. We don't yet know which bad code matters and what's fine. And so we need to be able to see what it's doing. Also, we don't have to do the typing anymore, so it's easier.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So, a little bit more downstream, you want to have more of a safety net before the code goes into production.
Oh, or during. I mean, depending on the risk profile of your app. Well, also, everyone should be testing in production. Your customers are testing in production. Try looking at the results.
Yeah, right? Try actually engaging with what, because that's how you learn too. And I think that's what you're saying, right? The learning, the volume of the learning for people new, but also for us, we can just learn faster, right? Because we can practice more. We can do more practice in a shorter amount of time, and it's practice that.
Yeah. Ooh, and we can build scaffolding.
Say more about that.
So GPOD talks about this a lot. A lot of what we code is actually scaffolding. It's tests. It's deploy scripts. It's automation. It's automation of manual integration tests. You know, now when I need to test something by clicking in the browser a couple times and seeing that it looks okay, that was so hard to automate. Depends on how much I've loaded in my brain, but I don't want to load up a JavaScript testing framework when I'm writing a Python app. That's like expensive. But I can have the AI write a script to do that manual test for me. And then I can have it run its script every time it makes a change. And then I have to care about whether that script is a decent expression of what the app needs to do. But I don't have to care what that code looks like because it is scaffolding. So I can get way more scaffolding, way faster. And that's not going to production. If in its playwright script, it is actually trying three different things to pull the trace ID out of the browser data, and two of those are complete garbage and will never work, but one of them does, and the rest is just cruft, oh well, it's cruft. It runs on my computer, and I don't care. So scaffolding is now more available to us, and it's also way cheaper because I need to look at all the code that's going into production. I need to find out when it's cheating and making the tests pass without actually doing the thing. Mm-hmm. It's good at that.
Yeah, because our brains are good. Our brains are good at, I noticed this in myself, how I never see the problem I create. Somebody else or something else has to see that. Like, I can see it if I didn't generate it. But if I generated it, it's completely invisible to me, which to me is why we have the tools like we have, right?
The stuff I left on the kitchen counter, well, I know why it's there. It's fine. The stuff my family members leave on the kitchen counter, oh, what a mess. So sloppy. What is this doing here? This thing is stupid, you know?
Yeah. And it's the go, I go have a slice of pizza or take a shower or whatever and come back and look at the code and I go, oh, or ask for help. Oh. And so to me, you're describing this at a systems level, right? Knowing that there's always going to be these blind spots or these gaps and that
well, it feeds into them.
Yeah.
The AI will, it does this sycophancy thing of telling you what you need to see of passing the tests or deleting the tests if you let it get away with that. Of making everything look green, of falling back on a failure to something that might have been returned by the downstream system. And so you can't see the failure until you get to production or load test. And you're like, why is it returning the same value every time? That's not right. But it was good enough to get it past your sniff test, right? So you really... You have to watch it.
Yeah, the because it's always delusion in systems, right? Delusion is always, whether it's a human system or it's the delusion that's what.
Well, and sometimes that's what lets us work, right? Because we can't understand the whole system. This is part of the system is broken, and we can keep working. Is we don't understand the whole system, and we don't understand what we're trying to go to. No, we can't imagine utopia. Whatever you imagine, it's bad. That's not what we need to imagine the perfect future that we're trying to get to. We need to imagine the next better state from here. Not what should we do, what can we do?
Right.
And how do we get so that the next time we have more options, we have more ways to respond.
And more insight, I think, right?
Yeah.
Like, and more of the... We don't want just the pile of information. We want the right information at the right time that helps us make the right decision when there is no such thing as right. We have to actually discern, right?
Yeah, yeah. So what I want the system to do first is to tell me what it did. I don't know exactly what the right thing to do is every time, but I know I'm going to need to know what the heck you did. And then we can come back with more information, make it a little better, a little smoother, and move forward with better responses.
I will say another confession, the using AI for the scaffolding and especially the testing script almost makes me teary because in terms of typing, that's the one I most want to balk at all the time, my entire career. Yeah. And I hadn't thought about this. I'm like, oh, Jess. Oh my gosh.
I can have all the tests. Okay. So the other day, I'm making a toy agent. I'm having an AI agent write an agent and with a lot of help from me. I feel like it can create this like blob of Play-Doh. And I got it on the fifth try. I got it to create some software that was close enough that I could start squishing the Play-Doh into shape. So I'm working with that. And I've got it outputting a conversation. So my code is calling into an LLM. Well, it's a fake LLM named Frank right now, because otherwise it just, I'm like, stop. You've already spent 50 cents at Anthropic and all you're doing is spinning on stuff that doesn't work. Stop it. Right. We're going to talk to Frank now. And I'm focused on making it tell me what's going on. So this was an idea that I stole from one of its sad implementations, but it writes the conversation history. And then I can have Frank replay back the conversation between the prompt LLM function call prompt LLM. And then I was like, man, it's in a big JSON file. This would be way easier to read if it was like cow say, right? And the cow played the role of the prompt and a dragon maybe played the role of the LLM. Boom, make me a script that reads this JSON file And the cow always prints the new prompt, and then a dragon on the right always prints what Frank said. Done. Right. And now I'm happy. Now I can read my conversations and enjoy it. And it turns out it's really, really good at drawing cows in ASCII. And it has no idea how to draw a dragon. It drew like some lines and some little peaks. And I was like, that is the saddest dragon. And I love it.
I've given up on anything visually rendering because I'm not good at it. So I do need real support in visual rendering. And just like, no, honey, no, that, no, that's like, no, like sometimes I get an image that an image or a suggestion for an image or a visual ASCII or something that's helpful, but mostly I'm.
It's great at mermaid diagrams.
Huh.
Which will show up in your README on GitHub. And it's also great at HTML and CSS because it can run Playwright MCP, and I configure the MCP for Playwright in the agent. It can run the browser. It can look at the output. It can take a screenshot, and I can ask it to modify the appearance of a website, which is done with text. And it gets farther than I would in a short amount of time.
That is true. I'm trying to...
Unless I know how to do it, and then I just do it.
Yeah. I'm trying to move components that I've built in a completely different tool into another front-end tool, and that is not my strong point, but it is much faster at doing that than I'm doing it. If it's translating into Tailwind, for example, like translate HTML and CSS structure, grid structure, but into Tailwind syntax. That takes me a long time.
That doesn't even sound fun either.
No.
Yeah, no. But it can do that, and then we can fix the problems.
Right.
When it gets stuck, we're there. We have the responsibility. We respond to the problems after it gives it a try.
Yeah. Well, as you say, I didn't really think about this, right? But that if you don't have to do all the heavy lifting, you get to discern which heavy lifting matters to lift. And that's really important. I suppose I'm not sure that I've yet trusted we're good at that discernment.
And that's us, right? This is how we have to be good. Not just at coding, but at knowing when to do the coding, when to delegate the coding, and when to accept what it does or reject it. And what I loved about software, what I loved about programming specifically in college, when I started as a physics major, and that was super fun until we got to quantum mechanics. And then I was like, what do you mean? You can't know for certain where the electron is. What do you mean you can't predict its trajectory and it's all statistics? Screw this. I'm going to programming where it's deterministic.
I love about our shared history, because also in studying physics, I'm like, what is this linear mechanistic bullshit? Like, okay, I can like memorize this, and then I get to quantum and I'm like, this is real.
Yeah,
this
but I bet you were stuff. Older. You weren't, yes. You weren't 20.
That's true. That is true. And also, but when I was 20, I wasn't interested in any of it. I was just interested in having fun. And if it wasn't fun, then that's not interesting to me. So my definition of fun has changed. To this though, I feel like one, we've come full circle because I hadn't thought of this way. It's really interesting. Where originally you were saying we were talking about the relationships between software parts and controlling and changing what you can and making better interfaces, better boundaries, better ability to respond. And I'm hearing you say the same thing about our relationship to AI as a tool for our work. It is the quality of the relationship we develop, what's being communicated, what we're asking, how we use what we're hearing, discerning which to do. Like the quality of the relationship between me and the responses and the AI, like AI is the downstream system I'm learning to have
it's
a good relationship.
It's not deterministic
with.
Like that code. And we, you know, it's different. We don't get full control anymore. But it turns out relinquishing control gives us the opportunity for a lot of response. And the AI tools are powerful in a way that our perfectly correct auto completions were not.
Yeah. And so for my, I'm going to ask a question and I apologize ahead of time because it's not really fully formed in my head. So maybe it doesn't lead us anywhere fruitful and maybe it's right into the garden. Hmm. So I'll start with a statement. One of the things I'm discovering, and I don't know what to make of it, so I haven't talked about it very much, is that as a person always thinking about understanding and describing systems, I have found that my AI tools understand me better than kind of anyone has before.
Oh, wow.
Because asynchronicity and what it means to architect these relationships, that I have usual rants and frustrations about sort of being asynchronously designing in a linear thinking world. And what I'm finding is that the yes responses, the help in thinking about this is actually good. And I'm surprised by this and I don't know what to make of it. So I'm sort of still in the closet of, I secretly use it a lot more than I'm confessing now because it's helping me design a front end monorepo using PNP and workspaces, which I hadn't done before, which is, there's not a lot of documentation on asynchronicity. I think my question is, that it's a tool that improves your thinking because mm-hmm. it makes it faster and it gives you information faster. Mm. But is it also helping you in as a systems designer and finding leverage points and knowing these more nuanced things that are really hard for us? How is AI improving that skill for you or is it?
I'm not there yet. No, and also the systems that I'm working on are still demo apps. I'm not working on our production Honeycomb systems.
Well, so to this is beautiful because correct. And then when I just tried on my laptop, I was away and I downloaded the repo I worked on and tried to spin it up on my laptop and it didn't because it's not robust because there were packages missing that I had on my local, like it as a demo app, it helped me, but as a production something, it was very far away. So I think that, yeah.
Very different. Now I will use it on existing fairly large demo code bases, but I haven't got far enough. But I find it interesting that you talk about how it helps you think. And if we use it well, it can help us think. If we try to get it to do the thinking, total failure.
Yes, that's the thing, is that I was hearing a lot about how you get it to do the thinking, and that brought a lot of my doubt and aversion.
No, you get it to do the typing. And then separately, like in chat, especially when it has a good context engine and it can dig around in the code base and point you to things that might matter. And when I hook it up with a Honeycomb MCP, it can also do queries about what's happening in the software when it's live, which is helpful. Mm. So it can go gather context and it can run a lot of queries and it can dig around and bring stuff to me that I wouldn't otherwise find because it's just too much work. Yeah, it can totally contribute to the thinking, but the thinking is still yours.
And the questions. So I like this. So I think if we come back to concrete, my least favorite word, but only because overused, but to the point it's good in software, come back around, then the people that listen to this conversation and think, all right, I'm going to experiment with my thinking relationship.
And I will point out concretely, one thing that you can do to improve the relationship, unlike a person, it's not going to magically learn your style over time. Your interactions with it are not persistent, but you can put stuff in its memories. You can put stuff in its guidelines file, whichever the different agents have different file names that they use for this, but you can change its instructions. And so whenever it makes me really mad, I'm like, how do I make that not happen again? And I either need to change my prompts or more often change my instructions.
So it knows the scope of what to consider or in the why
yeah,
of
so
what
I'm
to consider.
I'm like, don't write tests unless I ask you to write tests because it loves to write a bunch of crappy tests with a bunch of mocks. Does it still write tests that I didn't ask it to? Yes, but fewer.
Yeah. Mine is like when we're solving a bug, stop giving me the answer you've given me 8 times. I've already showed you this is correct. Yeah. You have nothing.
So even with the AI, we can work on the relationship.
And that, so to begin is the, I guess what I'm thinking is for people that have listened to this and been like, yeah, okay, so this is good. Like I want to put my hands into something. Maybe the more concrete start place is what is the typing or what is the investigation that I'm doing that I could deploy AI to do some of that typing.
Or what is the scaffolding? What is the yak I would love to shave? What is the script that I wish I had, but it's way too much work? It's clearly not worth it. Well, it is when it's not you doing the work and it's just spinning for 5 minutes and it's done.
Yeah. Okay. The script I wish I had.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's too
try
much.
Try it for that.
Yeah. Perfect. Wait, just thank you as always. This is delightful. And I'm going to, I feel more friendly and less doubtful. So I hope that's true for everyone. So thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.